Vision Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. Today is May 25th, 2017. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here on the West Coast. Thank you for joining us. We are going to have with us Mr. Carl Grossman. He asked me to give him a call right at 8 o'clock, so that's what I'm going to do instead of him just hanging on waiting until we get there. And I want to tell you, I'm pretty excited. We had a nuclear victory.
Sure I am.
Hi, Carl. Thank you for joining us. I'm super excited to have you on and share the victory news with everyone today about the victory we had in Oregon last night. We actually stopped the new scale liars from sneaking through a bill of legislation through the House last night. So, and we got the House chairman of the committee to say that this bill will not be brought back up this session. It's actually too late, even if they tried. There's not enough votes in the House. So it's definitely a done deal.
Wonderful. So, it just shows that Oregon is a very special state. I've always felt that way.
Well, I'll tell you what, there was a lot of people in the room. Like, the word went around and people were quite angry because we don't know how this got through the Senate, but it did get through the Senate. And so yesterday, Nancy Newell, it was on what day? Tuesday. I was interviewing Sheila Parks right at the end of the show. The phone kept ringing off the hook. So I called him back and she's like, she told me about this, and so I made a bunch of phone calls and emailed people, and I guess everybody who heard about it did because the room was packed, and people were there. And you could see NewScale. You could see NewScale, Jose Reyes, and Catherine Haley from the University of Oregon. They're the nuclear – I call them the nuclear liars. They pump their lies all the way through. They're relentless, too, because they don't care.
Yep.
You know, they have no, they're not going to jail. It doesn't matter how many people they murder. They have the Price-Anderson Act. We should talk about the Price-Anderson Act. I'm sure you know all about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, most people are not aware. I mean, a listener has to do, maybe after the program, is go to your homeowner's insurance, if you own a home, or a renter's insurance policy. And you will see on every homeowner's policy in this country, a clause, they call it the nuclear clause, which says, in fact, I reprint in my book, Cover Up What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, the so-called nuclear clause in my homeowner's insurance, which is through Allstate. I mean, you may be in good hands with Allstate, but if there is a nuclear disaster, Allstate can do virtually nothing because of something called the Price-Anderson Act. And the history, which I get into in Cover Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. And incidentally, parenthetically, if people would like to get a free copy of that book, of Cover Up, all you have to do is go to my website, Carl Grossman, that's Carl with a K, Grossman.com, and hit on books. And through the generosity of the publisher, the newest edition of Cover Up is available for a download for absolutely free. in any case, in the book, early in the book, in fact, because I think it's so important, as you do, Lonnie, I get into the Price-Anderson Act and get into the history in the book of the Price-Anderson Act. And what it involves is utilities in the United States being very fearful about nuclear power and being concerned about what's called exposure. In other words, people suing them if one of these new nuclear plants that were being promoted in the 1950s erupted in an accident. And incidentally, also in 1957, when the Price-Anderson Act was passed, the first major study on the consequences of a nuclear accident, a nuclear power plant accident, was done at Brookhaven National Laboratory here on Long Island in New York. And in fact, I reprint facsimiles, pages from that report. It's WASH 740 is the title, WASH for Washington. And it talks about thousands upon thousands of deaths, talks about the potential of billions in damage, $7 billion, in fact, to put it precisely. In any case, the same year in 1957, also the same year, 57, the first commercial nuclear power plant in the United States was opened, that shipping port near Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. And Louis Strauss, the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, says, if you, the utilities, don't build these nuclear plants, Shippingport was built by supervised by Admiral Hyman Rickover, the construction, and really built by the Atomic Energy Commission and the Division of Naval Reactors, which Rickover comes out of. And here's Strauss threatening, this is the stick, threatening utilities in the United States, you build these nuclear plants, or we, the government, will. That was the stick. Now, the carrot was the Price-Anderson Act. It was passed merrily by Congress, and what it said then is that if there's an accident, a catastrophic accident at a nuclear power plant, the total liability would be capped, limited, to $560 million, and the government would pay the $500 million of the $560 million. In other words, the utilities would be stuck with just $60 million. Again, this is the same year the WASH 740 report was done, talking about $7 billion in damages. And as the years went by, the damage estimates for a nuclear power plant accident have gone up and up and up to, at this point, around $300 billion for a U.S. nuclear power plant accident.
You know how much the Wikipedia says is currently funded through the amount, the no-fault insurance type of system? $12.6 billion. You just said $300 billion. It's $12.6 is the insurance. So after right. $12.6, we pick up the rest of the money, folks. It goes right to the American government. We have to pay for it.
Yeah, well, originally it was the government going to play the lion's share of the $560 million. And as the years went by, this was all adjusted. So today, the utilities have kind of pooled their assets to say, well, we'll pay now, but this is the limit, a little over $12 billion. If you expect to get anything more, if you're living near Diablo Canyon, the two nuclear right. power plants in California, the Diablo Canyon plants, or here, I'm speaking to you from New York, the Indian Point plants, also two, just 26 miles north of New York City. And both the Diablo Canyon plants and the Indian Point plants are just essentially next to earthquake faults. And if one of those earthquake faults erupts and you'd have a catastrophic accident at Diablo Canyon or Indian Point or any of the now 99 nuclear power plants in the U.S., the whole limit of liability would be what these insurance companies, what these utilities have pooled their money to pay, $12 billion today. So they've upped the $560 million to $12.6 billion, but that's still far from enough. In fact, the Fukushima disaster goes way past.
Trillions.
Way
past. We don't even know. I mean, it's horrible.
Yeah, but this was the carrot. And people aren't familiar with it. And
yeah, but why
if you
want to
extend
why?
The issue further, give a call to your Allstate agent or your Farmers Insurance or any insurance company and say, you just heard on the radio, you just heard on Lonnie Clark's show about the Price-Anderson Act. limiting liability in the event of a nuclear plant accident. And I'd like a rider on my policy. Like, you can get a rider on your policy for jewelry and other, you know, extra kinds of things to get protection for. Ask your insurance company about a rider on an accident at a nuclear power plant, and your agent will say, no, I'm sorry, we can't do it. We just can't write those kind of policies. And it's because the agent will probably not know, because of this way back in 57, consider how many years ago 57 was, but it's still the law of our land, pushed through by the nuclear promoters back in 57, limiting liability event of a nuclear power plant accident.
57 was the same year that the WHO entered into a contract with the United Nations, allowing the with the IAEA, allowing the IAEA to oversee all of their studies. That was a very evil year. That was
very evil. And if listeners aren't too aware of that, it's so important. Based on this notion of atoms for peace, a complete bit of baloney, a absolute BS, atoms for peace. Atoms, you know, the nuclear power, it's a two-sided coin. Atoms for war and then civilian nuclear power. It's all mixed together. In any case, based on the baloney of atoms for peace, Dwight Eisenhower addressed the United Nations and called for an international agency to do what our U.S. Atomic Energy Commission had been doing, pushing nuclear power here in the United States. So formed by the UN was the International Atomic Energy Agency, kind of as a mirror image of our Atomic Energy Commission. Well, our Atomic Energy Commission was eliminated because it was, and here's Congress long in the pocket of the nuclear industry. Nevertheless, the U.S. Congress in 1974 eliminated the Atomic Energy Commission because its two missions were to promote nuclear power and at the same time regulate nuclear power, and wiped it out, got rid of the AEC, and instead put a Nuclear Regulatory Commission in to regulate, and then later on a Department of Energy to do the promotion. But in fact, both the NRC and the Department of Energy have the pro-nuclear mindset, so the NRC still pushes nuclear power. It's never the NRC, like the AEC, turned down a license for a nuclear power plant anywhere, anytime in the United States. Anyway, meanwhile, even though the AEC was put out of business, was eliminated, we still have the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is based in Vienna. And it has a deal, which is what you're talking about, with the major international health organization, the WHO, the World Health Organization. I mean, you can Google the agreement, mm-hmm. And the agreement is that if WHO does anything, studies, reports, or whatever involving radiation or nuclear technology, that report, that study would have to be vetted, would have to go through this terribly pro-nuclear International Atomic Energy Agency, which can and does censor such reports. It's absolutely a scandal. And then in terms of
it's genocide, actually. It's really murder, to be honest. What they're doing, they really are. It's like they think they're playing God. The nuclear priesthood is, as Alvin Weinberg called themselves. They believe this. And it was interesting last night. Let me just, if you don't mind, I'm going to go into this business about
please.
What happened.
It's such an important story. It's a good, so it's good news, Lonnie. Tell the good news story.
It is good news. And this is what's good about it, is it shows that it does matter who we elect. It does matter for citizens to stay engaged. I got a call from Nancy Newell. Any of my listeners listening it on Tuesday when I was interviewing Sheila Parks, the phone was ringing off the hook and I was a bit annoyed afterwards. I'm like, who is this? Because everybody that knows I'm on the radio. So it was Nancy Newell going, guess what? NuScale's trying to get through a bill. It passed the Senate. That bill, 990 in Oregon, was written to override the Oregon voters since 1980. Oregon law has been no nuclear plants can be built in Oregon until they have a solution for nuclear waste, and then we can put it up to a vote for the whole state. This new bill that they got passed through the Senate, it calls it a sleek bill. It overrode the state law and said that any city or county in the state that wants the new scale facilities can decide themselves that they're going to build it, because these are small nuclear reactors. They don't present the same danger. They have what the catchphrase saliency or something like that. And resiliency. They called it resiliency because they're burying the nuclear waste in the ground. The design of these new small nuclear reactors is they build them the same size that you build a nuclear reactor, the facility, but instead of two big pods, they're going to build 12 small ones and build them as they go. And they have never been built. And the room was packed. I mean, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility was there. There was a women's group who is out of Portland that was there. I mean, people showed up in mass. The room was really packed. And it was, and there was Kevin Finnegan from Comac, New York, actually testified. And he mentioned this thing about Lawrence. It wasn't the Lawrence the lab over there. What's the name of the lab that you just mentioned?
Lawrence Livermore Laboratory.
Yes, he lived very near there, and he has family members and known people who died because of those spills and leaks over there. And he gave that testimony, and he's, you know, he's 23, I think. And he looked at him, and he said, this is genocide. He looked at him, and he said, this is a crime against humanity. This should not happen. We should not be going towards nuclear. It was great. We had a lot of people with testimony giving. You can, anybody who wants to listen to the testimony, it was an hour and a half meeting. It started at 3 o'clock. It went to really 5 o'clock because they allowed everybody who wanted to testify, they allowed everybody to show up to talk. So it went a little bit over because there was a lot of people who said no way. And you can find it at, you have to add the www, otherwise you won't get it. That's what Representative his name is escaping me, but it's www.oregonlegislature.gov. And you just look for, it's on the one for 425. It's going to be up this, 424, it'll be up today. And they, all of these things are filmed and you can see them all. And you can actually track how the legislation went. And that was one of the things that, his name is Phil Barnhart, Representative Phil Barnhart. He said, look, because some people said, look, this is trying to get sneaked through. What are you guys doing? And they were very angry. He said, look, the way it works, I know you don't have your time to pay attention to the Oregon calendar, but follow an organization who is watching this, and they probably have a calendar, or create one yourself so that every session, because he says, we can't guarantee they won't come back next year, because they tried to do this last year. It got stopped early. This time it got through the Senate. And this is just an indication that we need to pay attention, because they're not going away year after year after year. They will come back because they can murder anybody they want. They don't care.
Yeah.
There's no cap. Not only do they, we're talking about the financial cap on the Price-Anderson Act. The Price-Anderson Act also has this caveat that no individual or corporation can be held. They're all immunized. They cannot be, they're completely, they cannot be held accountable for knowingly or unknowingly causing harm to human life or the biota for any reason whatsoever. Nobody goes to jail. Nobody's accountable. There's no answer. That's the Price-Anderson Act. They can do willy-nilly whatever they want. People can get murdered, and then they don't even have to pay that much. It's an outrageous law. I mean, to think that we couldn't even buy a car, you know, we all have to have car insurance. Because the industry, but check this out, the nuclear industry can't get insurance. That's why we have the Price-Anderson Act, because all the insurers said, no, we're not doing it. It's too dangerous.
Yeah, well, they were forced. I mean, some people believe.
Carl, you understand this history. Why were they forced? When you said, I didn't understand the carrot and the stick idea of the Price-Anderson Act.
Yeah.
Why did we have the stick? What was going on that caused the stick? Why did our government decide to turn on the American people like that?
Well, it wasn't just the government. I mean, people, you know, let me explain it, because to understand the history today is very important. I mean, you mentioned the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, And there is this string of national nuclear laboratories in the United States. This is part of the nuclear establishment, this atomic priesthood. And in fact, when you mentioned the term nuclear priesthood, atomic priesthood, uttered by Alvin Weinberg, he was the director at the time of Oak Ridge National Laboratory. So you have all over this country these national laboratories, national nuclear laboratories. The one that I had earlier mentioned that had done the first report on the consequences of a nuclear power plant accident, Brookhaven National Laboratory, was specifically set up by this nuclear establishment in 1947 to develop civilian uses of nuclear technology and also do atomic research. But principal focus was developing nuclear power plants and food irradiation and nuclear-powered airplanes and nuclear-powered rockets and anything nuclear. Question, how did this all happen? And it happens because of a crash program, which many listeners are familiar with, the Manhattan Project. And that was kicked off in 1939 by a letter from Albert Einstein to President Roosevelt. Einstein and other physicists who were refugees from Europe, Einstein from the Nazis in Germany, knew that in 1938 in Germany, they had done fission, splitting of the atom. And the concern of these scientists, Einstein and Leo Szilard from Hungary and Enrico Fermi from Italy, was running from the Mussolini and the fascists and came here. And Edward Teller, Hungarian, escaping what was occurring in Europe then. And now suddenly Hitler, they feared these scientists could develop a nuclear weapon out of fission, out of splitting the atom. And what the letter that Einstein wrote to, in fact, as a facsimile, I reprint parts of that letter.
It's in your
book. In cover-up. I think it's so important. Suggested a crash program to kind of fight fire with fire, to develop a program in the United States to work towards the construction of nuclear weapons before the Germans would do this. And that's what became the Manhattan Project. And a general was put in charge of it from the Army Corps of Engineers. A fellow named Oppenheimer from California became the scientific director. And it worked year after year after year to develop nuclear weapons, the atomic bomb, and ultimately succeeded and built atomic bombs that were dropped on Japan. Germany had meanwhile been defeated, but Japan hadn't, and the decision was made to use some of these atomic bombs that were made on Japan. And then, and this is the important, this is the key point in terms of what your question you ask, why the push, why the nuclear Pinocchios, why the these dangerous nuclear power plants scattered all around this country, why the Price-Anderson Act and so forth. Those involved in the Manhattan Project, the scientists, the bureaucrats, the engineers, and also the corporate contractors, Westinghouse and GE, were the principal contractors, private contractors, for the Manhattan Project in 47 and 48. They desperately looked for more things to do with nuclear technology than just build nuclear weapons. I mean, ultimately, 30,000 nuclear weapons were built, the atomic bomb, and also this Edward Teller fellow, he wanted to build the, what he called the super, the hydrogen bomb, and he was given his own laboratory to work on, the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, to work on that. They looked, what else can we do with nuclear power, nuclear technology? And the answer to the question, in part, laid in, that place that just in recent weeks we've heard about nuclear waste problems at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, not far from you in the state of Washington. Well, at Hanford, they had built during the Manhattan Project period what they called production reactors, These were reactors which would produce plutonium. There was two roads that were taken during the Manhattan Project.
This is why we have all this plutonium up here in the Northwest. They specifically it up this way.
Wow. Well, but they built these reactors. There was two roads that were taken in terms of trying to look for fuel for atomic weaponry. One was high-grade, what they call high-grade uranium. Uranium with lots of uranium-235 in it. And then Oak Ridge, in fact, where Weinberg was the director, was set up to heighten the amount of uranium-235, which splits. So it could be, the Hiroshima bomb was 90% uranium-235, so-called enriched uranium. A lot of you, see, U-235 is fissile, it splits.
Wow.
But most naturally occurring uranium only contains 0.7% U-235. And then the other road that was taken was building these really plutonium production reactors in Hanford. And what occurs when there's fission is that what most of uranium is uranium-238, which doesn't fission. It's not fissile. It doesn't split. But in proximity to fission, the U-238 atom will pick up a neutron and become plutonium-239, and it's fissile, and it'll split. So the Nagasaki bomb was fueled with plutonium, and almost all of the atomic bombs since plutonium. And the hydrogen bomb has a plutonium trigger, which sets off fission triggers in fusion in the hydrogen bomb. But in any case, what was established during the war was this nuclear establishment. And after the war, it and its corporate contractors, Westinghouse and GE, which in fact are the Coke and Pepsi of nuclear power worldwide, 80% of nuclear power plants worldwide are of Westinghouse and or GE design or manufacture. So that's the story of how we've got where we've got. Now, in terms of today, it's very important to note that just in recent months, Toshiba had purchased, had purchased Westinghouse's nuclear operations. And Toshiba's nuclear operations, it's essentially its Westinghouse division, has gone bankrupt. It's nuclear power, besides being dirty.
Written any type of an addendum that says what's going to happen with the nuclear facilities? Have they got a plan? Like, where are the people who do they know? Is there another company they go to, say, if one of those plants needs a part?
Is it up in the air? Yeah.
Did they do it in a way that was responsible and leave it in the good care of somebody else? Like these grave, because there's a lot of grave decisions that have to be made at these Westinghouse plants.
Well, the talk now is that the Japanese government, which is led by a real pro-nuclear leader of Japan now, thinks it's the best thing to come along since sliced bread. So they're talking about a bailout of Toshiba's nuclear operations by the Japanese, but it's going to be an enormous bailout because nuclear power is dirty. I mean, you don't need a catastrophic accident to have radioactivity emitted from a nuclear plant. It's always routinely being emitted and allowed.
And not only that, you know what else? I sort of dug into this, Carl, because I kind of had this intuitive feeling that this nuclear stuff has caused a lot of the climate change. And you know what I dug into and found, according to Jeremy Rifkin, each nuclear facility produces every year tons of like nitric acid. Yeah. And that contributes to climate change. It helps to the greenhouse effect.
In terms of the nuclear cycle, you know, the mining, the milling, the so-called enrichment, because the nuclear plants also need enriched uranium. They can't work on uranium, you know, that's from the ground, which is so loaded with U-238, 99.3%. So it has to be enriched to 3% uranium-235, and that, which occurs in Oak Ridge, is a dirty process which involves all kind of emissions of greenhouse gases, which contributes to climate change, to global warming. So when these nuclear liars, as you call them, these nuclear Pinocchios, is a term I often use, you know, when they talk about nuclear power being necessary because of global warming, in fact, nuclear power is a culprit, is a cause of global warming. What we need to do is to, and we're doing it, I mean, all over this country. I mean, I just recently was in San Francisco last week, and San Francisco is going to become 100% renewable as a city. Here where I live on Long Island, East Hampton.
Yes, but a lot of these states, are they saying they're not going to go nuclear? Because a lot of them are saying renewable is nuclear.
Well, that's part of the nuclear Pinocchio maneuver at this point. There's a discussion of 100% renewable, the nuclear Pinocchios will say, well, nuclear is renewable. Renewable in the sense that if you wanted to recycle the nuclear waste while talking about dirty processes, taking that nuclear waste and extracting the plutonium, which is built up in a nuclear plant. I mean, it doesn't just Hanford, where it happened in these production reactors. In any nuclear power plant, there's 500 pounds of plutonium-239 produced annually. So they're bomb factories, among other things, in terms of what a country can do.
Say that again? Would you say that one more time?
They're bomb. I mean, the original plan in the United States and in the Soviet Union, which was quick on our heels in terms of nuclear technology, was to build, because I was trying to explain how nuclear power begins and how the answer was at Hanford, because these plants at Hanford, these production reactors to produce plutonium, also was a byproduct, produced heat. So there the folks in the nuclear establishment thought, hey, maybe what we can do is sell nuclear plants, and we can use that heat to boil water, turn a turbine, and make electricity. But in all the early documents of the Atomic Energy Commission, in many of the documents of the early Atomic Energy Commission documents, this is the 50s, what they talk about is dual-purpose reactors. In other words, what was seen in this country was not just a reactor to produce electricity, but a reactor that would produce electricity and plutonium at the same time for weaponry. Peaceful atom, baloney. And in fact, the Soviets, now Russia, have fully implemented that design. Their nuclear power plants produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. We, because of criticism early on, and the attempt to make believe Atoms for Peace was a reality, we've significantly limited the use of nuclear power plants, anything to do with nuclear weaponry. Nevertheless, it's been happening. At the TVA, you have the production of tritium for nuclear weaponry and so forth. So there's still a tie-in. But in any case, any country that has a nuclear power plant or a reactor, they're bomb factories. For example, India got its first reactor back in the 1970s, 74, and we, our Atomic Energy Commission, trained the engineers, and lo and behold, it was through the Atoms for Peace program, lo and behold, in short order, India had a nuclear weapon. And the point here is that any country that has a nuclear facility, a nuclear power plant, a reactor, even a research reactor, that they have the materiel, the plutonium, and the trained personnel to make a nuclear weapon. That's why I've said over and over again, and this sounds far out, but I've said over and over again, this carrot and stick approach that we've used in terms of proliferation, it's just not with the Price-Anderson Act, carrot and stick, but with nuclear proliferation, in other words, using civilian nuclear power for nuclear weaponry all around the world, the spread of nuclear power into military uses of nuclear power. The way we try to deal with that is with carrot and a stick, that, we'd have sanctions and all this if a country moves in that direction. On the other hand, we'll encourage civilian nuclear power. But in fact, there's no difference. There's no wall. There's no separation. Any country, as I say, with a nuclear reactor, a nuclear power plant, will then have the plutonium, and again, hundreds of pounds of plutonium produced in a nuclear power plant a year, 500 pounds of plutonium, 239 to be exact. And then the Nagasaki bomb, to give as an example, had a little less than 20 pounds of plutonium. So you got plenty of plutonium, and if you have, it's a kind of a dirty process, but if you want to extract that plutonium and make nuclear weapons, nations can. That's why I've said over and over again that what we have to have, and all over the world there are nuclear-free zones set forth by the United Nations in the Pacific, in Africa, in South America. I think, but that has to do with nuclear weapons. I think if our grandchildren and their grandchildren are going to make it, the whole planet needs to be a nuclear-free zone. No nuclear power and no nuclear weapons. And if we think this is far out, just try to continue this carrot and stick approach decade after decade as nuclear power plants proliferate throughout the world.
We won't have decades. We won't have plutonium will kill. I mean, this is the thing. We're talking about an extinction event. This is listen to this. This is the article. I cited this article in my testimony yesterday, Carl. I said to them, talk about safety culture. I said, I'm a student at the University of Oregon, and I have access to libraries. You know what I found? And I've read this on my YouTube channel. This is a scientific, it's a peer-reviewed journal. It's called the Accident Analysis Prevention. It's the homepage is ELSEVIER.com, Elsevier. I never heard of it, but that's its name. And this article was by a group of social scientists who studied, this is the title, Testing the Validity of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, Safety Culture Model. Now I'm going to read you two sentences. Listen to this. I read this. I could not believe it. During the last 25 years, the IAEA has continuously worked towards the conceptualization and theoretical development of safety culture and the creation of specific methodologies and tools for the assessment and development of strong safety cultures. Skip down to the next paragraph, the first sentence. Despite the relevance of the IAEA model to nuclear safety outcomes, its validity has never been empirically tested. Can you believe that? I mentioned this in my testimony. I said, look, it's never been tested. I dug it up. I'm going to make a copy and I'm going to send it to the chairman to ask him to please put it in the record, because we know how the nuclear liars are. They will scrub things. They find things. And I have it in my hand. I'm going to make a copy and put it in the record.
Well, in terms of empirical testing, in terms of nuclear safety, let me give as a good example the situation at these national nuclear laboratories through the years. Employees at these laboratories, so many have become victims of that radioactivity, the radiation at these nuclear laboratories. And the Atomic Energy Commission, as long as it existed, the Department of Energy, which still is in existence today, for years denied any connection between the cancers, widespread cancers suffered by workers in these national nuclear laboratories, and what they've been working with, the radioactivity. Only over a decade ago did the Department of Energy finally begin telling a bit of the truth, acknowledging, admitting the connection, and set up for these workers all over the country funds. In fact, there's one here at Brookhaven National Laboratory, major funds, without using our taxpayer dollars, incidentally, to compensate these poor workers who have ended up with
a story
largely
this week.
Cancer because of working with radioactivity.
Their whole, It's horrible, Carl. It's really, you're right.
A story I like to tell, it's a terrible story, but I like to tell it. It involves this Brookhaven National Laboratory. Where I live on Long Island, the first environmental county prosecutor was in the district attorney's office, was this goes back to the 1970s, was appointed. A fellow named Simon Cy Perchik lived in East Hampton. Well, his brother-in-law worked at Brookhaven National Laboratory, and because Perchik tried to and did begin taking steps to deal with the radioactivity, not just at Brookhaven National Laboratory and impacting the workers, but spewing out of the stacks at the high-flux beam reactor they had, getting into the Peconic River, which is the major east-west river on Long Island, and it ended up loaded with plutonium and cesium and strontium. It became the second hottest radioactive river in New York State, second to Cataracas Creek upstate, where they wanted to, years and years ago, do one of these recycling programs and so forth. And in the process, a big mess began. In any case, Cy's brother-in-law, and I write about this in a book I did called Power Crazy, which you can get through Amazon, wrote this book a number of years ago. Cy Perchik's brother-in-law wouldn't talk to him because of what he was doing, this environmental prosecutor to this Brookhaven National Laboratory, until he is diagnosed with this, the most serious case of cancer. And Cy goes on talking about how here his brother-in-law is on his deathbed and talking at long last now, reconciling with Cy and talking to him, and telling the story about one of the things that he was assigned to do at Brookhaven National Laboratory was they would empty some of these the fuel pools at the reactor, and he was given the assignment of taking a brush and scrubbing the residue from these pools, the white residue all over the walls of the pool, and he was given no mask, no protection systems. Why? Because at Brookhaven National Laboratory, they think radioactivity is no problem. In fact, in that book, Cover Up, which listeners can get for free, I reprint several pages of the safety manual National Laboratory.
I can't wait
which
to
begins,
get to that. Yeah.
Which begins with the question, is radioactivity dangerous? Well, it can be, but doesn't have to be. And also, in any case, if you want... let me say the comment I use in Power Crazy from Cy about Brookhaven National Laboratory, and this is very much in connection with being with his brother-in-law dying because of what he underwent as a worker at Brookhaven National Laboratory. Cy commented about experiments being done in the basement, the cellar,
right,
and no one watching. And if you want empirical evidence about the impacts of nuclear power, just look at the nuclear technology. Just look at the grants program that the DOE at long last has set up for National Nuclear Laboratory workers. And then also go look at safety manuals, not just at Brookhaven Lab. You can go to any of the labs, Los Alamos or Oak Ridge or up at Hanford. They underplay, they dismiss, they deny the dangers of radioactivity. This is despite,
and in the face of their own children getting sick, there are babies in 1 year, a couple years ago. I mean, there are children being born with microencephaly, and they're denying it's caused from this. I mean, the IAEA came in within three. I mean, the NRC came in within 3 months, had their doctors look at it and go, "Nope, not from us. Move on. Must be something the mothers did."
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, it is unconscionable. That's what I mean. Like, Kevin Finnegan, you know, he's a feisty young man. At yesterday's meeting, he wanted to, I want to go talk to Reyes. And I'm like, leave them alone. You know, don't get, because you know what? They murder enough people. You think it matters to them what you say to them. But the reality is they knew they lost. And I hope that we can provide them information to change their minds. Like, the students behind her went looked at me when they saw, when I they heard that the safety culture model that they use at their own facilities, at that testing facility up in Corvallis, does not work. They've never tested it. And when they did test it, they made eight barriers. Seven of the eight failed, and only one went up 50%.
Yeah. Well, it's something I've always been curious about. You know, like at Brookhaven Lab, a number of these labs that I've been involved with as a journalist looking into, some of these scientists call themselves nookies, sort of like moonies. So when you deal with nuclear power, it's, you know, I was discussing before how you have this vested interest out of Manhattan Project, which caused the beginnings of the push for nuclear power. You set up all these offices and you give these corporations contracts, and you get people who are trying to perpetuate their own interests, so these people with special interests. But with nuclear, I've found, because like I did a book on toxic chemicals years ago, too. I wrote a book on toxic chemicals, and the publisher asked me to find somebody who worked for a chemical company and get their rationale. And I found a fellow, he worked for American Cyanamid in New Jersey, one of the cancer capitals of America, incidentally. And he said, look, I had four kids. I had to make a living. I took the job with American Cyanamid. But when you get to nuclear, these people are, it's almost a semi-religious activity. And I've always wondered why, it's not just money. They kind of believe in it, the nukies. And why? Is it the proximity literally to power? Is it their narrow training? So many of them are products of the nuclear navy or atomic physics programs at various universities. In other words, very, very narrowly trained by also other true believers, other members of what they want to go into, the atomic priesthood. So the nuclear issue, I mean, I think that these people guilty of these crimes against the general population and against themselves, these workers at these national nuclear laboratories, for example, being poisoned by the work that they've done. I think that the people responsible for all this should be, prosecuted on the basis of the principles of Nuremberg. I mean, these are crimes against humanity that these nuclear promoters, this atomic priesthood, they have committed crimes against humanity. And they're not short-term crimes either. I mean, nuclear waste is going to be around these poisons for millions upon millions of years. Some of it ends up after its half-life in a few days, sometimes a few years, sometimes a few centuries, but some of it millions upon millions of years it's going to be around. They have left a legacy of poison for life on this planet. And not to be anthropocentric, it's not just people who are the victims of radioactivity and nuclear technology. I mean, they say that cockroaches are able to withstand 200 times the amount of radioactivity than human beings. But I don't think we should talk about the cockroaches inheriting the Earth. These people are guilty of crimes against humanity, not just in this generation and the next generation, but generation upon generation in the future.
And it has to stop based on that. Like, just stop. Because there's so many of them. This is why they're so afraid of us actually having this conversation. This is why I say, I am not interested in the guillotine. I would rather say to these people, shift your focus. We're going to stop making nuclear power plants. You're going to stop telling us how to keep recreating a failed experiment. We don't need the plutonium. We've got plenty. Thanks. Now let's deal with the waste that has been created. Figure out how do we undo this stuff and make science.
You're not going to undo it. It's going to be around. I mean, back.
We don't know that, Carl. There might be a way, but they haven't even looked. It's like
They have looked. With chemical poisons, they can be neutralized. when you talk about plutonium, when you talk about strontium-90, when you talk about cesium-137, when you talk about all these fission products,
it still has long-term damage.
You can't, once you create them, I mean, Rickover, and I've mentioned this on your show before, Rickover, after shipping port, after creating the nuclear navy, he finally, in 1982, saw the light, and he gave this farewell address to a committee of Congress, in which he said, and this is a guy who was part of the nuclear establishment, Abraham Rickover. This isn't Greenpeace. And what he told the Committee of Congress is that a few billion years ago, there was so much of this radioactivity on this planet as the planet was in the process of formation billions of years ago, that there couldn't be life on the planet. And life could only begin when this radioactivity cooled out, went through its half-lives and so forth. And then he goes on, again, Rickover, not Greenpeace, by building these nuclear power plants, by building these reactors, we're recreating something which precluded life from existing on this planet. And there, and this is Rickover. You can see that speech in Cover-Up. Again, people should download Cover-Up way at the back of the book.
I'm reading Cover-Up, Carl.
Yeah, in the back of the book, I have that Rickover speech. And it's also, Google it online. And then Rickover goes on, here, I think, this is Rickover, the human race is going to wreck itself. In other words, once we create these terrible poisons, they'll be around and around and must be somehow isolated from life for eternity. I mean, these are jobs for the atomic priesthood into eternity trying to do something. But you can't really do very much. Years ago, the notion was we'll put nuclear waste on rockets and send the rockets to the sun. But finally, they had to acknowledge that 1 out of 100 rockets blows up on launch. So they had to scuttle.
Okay, Carl, this is where I become like the eternal optimist. I think our thoughts are things. I think if we shift the culture, if we have a pivot away from the war machine and a look at this, and we have our scientists just dedicated to it, something will happen. Because at this point, if we continue down this path, we will not have great-grandchildren. That's the reality.
Well, the pivot, Lonnie, you can see in the agreement that has been made here in New York by Riverkeeper, Governor Andrew Cuomo, and others to shut down the two nuclear plants 26 miles north of the New York City line, the Indian Point plants. Part of the agreement for those plants in a few years, very few years, to shut down has to do with the workers. And under the agreement, the state commits itself to retraining the nuclear plant workers in safe, clean, green, renewable energy, solar and wind and so forth. So I think what we have to, I mean, that's a retraining of nuclear workers. But I think the answer to the issue of the nuclear nightmare is here, and that's the emergence. In fact, when I first wrote Cover-Up, the chapter I have in the original book on alternatives, solar, wind, and so forth, this I wrote way back. You know, this I wrote in 1979. Today, in 2017, safe, green nuclear power, it's here today. It can provide all the energy we need, all the power we need, and not kill people and other forms of life in the process. And so that is the pivot. The pivot has to be not like Abe, who is promoting nuclear power. Why? Because not only did Toshiba acquire Westinghouse, but Hitachi went into partnership with General Electric nuclear operations. So it's essentially the Coke and Pepsi of nuclear power. GE and Westinghouse are now Japanese brands. So Abe is pushing these Japanese brands. He's pushing nukes. But if we could have political leadership, and more important to me than anything, if we can have grassroots action, because to me, change occurs bottom up. Successful change historically is bottom up. It's from the grassroots. Do what San Francisco and East Hampton and so many other towns and many a country now is doing. Switzerland just committed itself. There was a referendum, no nuclear power, end nuclear power, and we're going to go 100% renewable. Commit ourselves.
Well, this is why yesterday's action was so good, because people, they thought they were going to sneak this through, and people got busy and the room was packed. And you could see the representatives, their attitude shift as they could feel the people in the room were not going to tolerate it. Like they, as they heard testimony after testimony, the people in the representatives, you could see their faces. They had changed. They were getting an understanding of how grave this was. I don't think, and you can see the Republicans get up. They peeled off. They left as they realized they weren't going to win the argument. Once they just left.
Well, I wish those Republicans that you talk about would realize that it's their right. Children too. It's them too that will be affected. But again, I think it's utterly wonderful that. This happened in the great state of Oregon, and I've spoken on nuclear power in the University of Oregon and in Eugene, and but what do they call your neck of the woods, Ecotopia?
And do they really? I don't know.
Yeah, Ecotopia, Oregon, Northern California.
It is pretty nice here.
It's not only nice, but people are. I hate to use this name Trump, but California and Oregon kind of represent a parallel universe to the.
But there are many people here who love Trump, though. Let's just be clear. There were people.
Well, there are, but not as many as in some other areas of this country. Loving Trump and his scoundrels. It's not just Trump. It's all these incredible characters that he has around him. The scoundrels. So, no, it's great, but to me, it can't just be California and Oregon. They have to lead the way.
Well, I think people are not. This is where the venue of the internet radio is, because this radio station gets heard out by other people. That's why I want to bring the real information across the airwaves. Like, it does matter. I was a guest on Chuck O'Chelly's show. Do you know he lives near nuclear power plants? Oh. And he didn't know that he could protect himself, but just finding out, when does these nuclear power plants have their annual cleaning? Because that's when most of the radiation comes out. The radioactive contamination is when they're doing their annual cleaning. So that is one way people, because we're there. We have to learn how to live in this environment. We have to face it. That's the first thing I think. We need to just face it and go, okay, this is the reality. And now
I think we got to stop it. I don't think we can live with it.
We do have to stop it. That's
for sure. We have to stop it. And the first stage is to gain an understanding, gain awareness, which is why I've spent decades upon decades doing journalism on nuclear power, educating people.
I don't think we're going to stop it until we get people to just even look at it, because eyes glaze over. They have been trained to glaze over, Carl.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think education and then action. Education alone is not going to do it. We need action.
That's perfect. You know, we have about 30 seconds left, Carl. I want to thank you for joining us this morning. I hope you'll come back in a few more weeks. It's awesome to have you.
A pleasure, Lonnie. All the time, a pleasure.
Well, look, go to carlgrossman.com, download his book. I am reading it. I'm a slow-paced reader because I'm busy. During the summer, I'll be able to read more of it. But go to Carl's page. Look around. He has fabulous books. And guess what? We can do this. We can lean into it. We can change the culture. We can create the policy. Put your courage feet on, you guys. Thank you, Carl, for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Okay. You guys, take care. Put your courage feet on. See you tomorrow. I guess I see you Monday. Or Chuck Johnson tomorrow. It's Chuck Johnson tomorrow. That's it.